It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Ever since the days of George Washington, U.S. presidents have been tested by crises. This hour, we want to examine all kinds of past crises in this country and look at how past presidents have measured up to major tests of their times. My guests, we're so glad to have two presidential historians with us who will take us back on this little time travel to notable presidential visions for survival and recovery in times of crisis throughout our history. Tim Walch is with us, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim, welcome to you.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon to you. Tim Naftali joins us as well, former director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library. Tim Naftali, welcome to you.
Hi, my pleasure. Hi, Ben.
Two Tims and a Ben this hour. That's what you have later in the hour. Yep. After we work through some history here, we want to have our Tims talk about, with this historical context, how the present occupant of the White House, Donald Trump, is dealing with the COVID crisis with this backdrop. But before that, we have plenty of wonderful audio archive audio to listen to this hour. Before we start taking a little bit of a time travel, I'd like to ask our Tims to have some thoughts about the criteria we're going to use to measure these past presidents or themes we'll be looking for. Tim Walch, what are your opening remarks here?
Well, one of the things that I hope people will do in this time of crisis is, of course, look at leadership models. Doris Kearns Goodwin has a book on leadership, presidential leadership in particular. And she's kind of distilled out some qualities I think we need in leaders, and I think we see it in our great leaders. And she has what you might say eight points, one of which is, of course, be aware that all the eyes of the country, all the people of the country are looking to you for direction and support. So when a president speaks in a time of crisis, his words, up to now, his words matter. The president needs to have a vision of survival, a vision of how we go forward, giving people a sense of confidence. We also want our presidents to be open to listening to others. The president of the United States isn't necessarily the smartest person in the room, so there are other ideas, and we want that president to be open to those ideas, particularly in a time of crisis. We want them to have a command of the facts. They can't make things up or give aspirational views. We want them to know the difference between being too stubborn and to persevere. We should always acknowledge that the values and life experiences that they've had in the past will often shape their responses to future crises and troubles. But the most important thing, and you hear this repeatedly, I think, in historians' evaluation of other presidents in crises, we want our presidents to tell the truth.
Even if it's bad.
Feel confident. Even if it's bad.
Even
if it's bad. You can hear this, for example, in Governor Cuomo's daily briefings. I mean, it's jarring. And to some extent, Dr. Fauci as well. I mean, again, he's an expert, not a president. But we can't gloss things over.
Mm.
And so those are hallmarks in times of crisis, whether it's war or whether it's a medical epidemic, public health epidemic, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Tim Naftali, what do you have to add to that?
I would add to that very good list that presidents shouldn't talk more than they need to. I think that as we go through some of the past crises, and we will see that the most successful leaders have not always been talking and have chosen those moments when to speak. For example, Franklin Roosevelt's famous and important fireside chats, well, there were roughly 30 of them between 1933 and 1944. They didn't happen every day, not even every week. And I think there's a reason for that. I think that at a time like this, one of the ways to ensure that presidents don't spread misinformation is to make sure that the briefings are from people who are very close to the situation and are expert in it. That's why during wartime, we became accustomed to weekly or daily briefings from the Pentagon, not from the White House. during the Gulf War, President George H.W. Bush wasn't giving daily briefings from the White House, but we were learning from the Pentagon, similarly in the Iraq War. So I think it's that presidents also have to choose their moments for speaking, and this president has decided to make it a daily event.
Mm-hmm. Let's, before we get into the 20th century, you mentioned Roosevelt. We'll have some audio from him. But Tim Walsh, take us back to early American or earlier American history. Where do you want to start? What crisis and what president would you like to match up?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the things we need to remember is that all presidents have some crises that they're faced with during their administration to a greater or lesser extent. And I suppose we're touching upon the more significant ones. And much forgotten now, but important at the time, was the first crisis faced by George Washington in the 1890s or the 1790s. Shortly after he'd become president, when in fact whiskey distillers in western Pennsylvania rebelled against paying a tax. And although we might seem to think this is kind of trivial, at the time it was a challenge to the executive authority of the president and the federal government. And in fact, although Washington resolved the crises without too much damage and danger, he actually led the forces of the federal government, the militia as provided to him by the states, to go to western Pennsylvania to put the rebellion down. So even George Washington, who we tend to think of as sort of a marble man whose presidency is kind of well into the past, faced a crisis. And then shortly thereafter, we certainly have to remember James Madison facing, in some ways, the penultimate crisis with the British army coming into, after defeating the American forces at Bladensburg, coming into the new capital at Washington and burning the White House. We still remember the famous story. It was said that it was Dolly Madison, but it wasn't in fact Dolly Madison, but rather a slave, Paul Jennings, who removed the portrait, the Gilbert Stuart portrait of George Washington, from its frame and took it as the government fled Washington. And it was only a thunderstorm, maybe a tornado of some power that actually put the flames out, but Washington was in ruins. So those two crises were really an enormous challenge to the federal government, to the legitimacy of the government, and faced by our presidents. And as Tim suggests, it's presidents taking action, not necessarily words. We don't necessarily remember what Madison had to say about the burning of Washington, but continuity of government, that he literally took the Congress and the presidency, moved out to a little town called Brooksville, I think it was, and continued government. And then, of course, we were fortunate to rebuff the British at Fort McHenry and then eventually at New Orleans, and the war, generally speaking, turned more successful. But Madison and Washington, early presidents who faced really significant crises for them at that time.
If you've just joined us, Tim Walsh and Tim Naftali, two presidential historians, we have the pleasure of listening to, interacting with this hour as we talk about how presidents have dealt with crises in past U.S. history. Let's go a little further into the 19th century with you, Tim Naftali. Do you want to go for the big one in the 19th century?
You mean the Civil War?
Absolutely.
I think remember that, think of it this way, there is the appearance of the time, how people thought of the leadership and the exercise of power, and then it's how we've thought about it in retrospect. Some presidents have looked better in retrospect, like Harry Truman, than they did at the time. Lincoln showed leadership at the time, and has continued to look good in retrospect. Lincoln made a decision, which was not inevitable, at the time of Fort Sumter. He made a decision that he was not going to try to find a diplomatic way out of this crisis. The Southern states made clear that they did not want to live under a Lincoln administration. in that era, the transition was long. It, first of all, there wasn't exactly one election day. There depended on the states, but the president, the votes would be roughly in November, and then the president was not inaugurated until March in that era. It was not until Franklin Roosevelt, his second term, that the inauguration was moved to its now fixed time of either January 20th or 21st, depending on whether the 20th is a Sunday or not. So in that period, there was a long transition, and it was during that transition that American politics heated up. And what Lincoln did from the get-go was say, I'm president of the entire United States, and I will not permit sedition. That was not an inevitable decision by Lincoln. And by the way, it was not necessarily popular, even with some of his inner circle. But he made the point from the start that he understood his role as president as keeping the country together and not permitting it to fall apart. Now, with time, that decision became even more beloved. But at the moment he made it, it was a controversial decision. He continues to make controversial decisions. He fires his commanding general. So one of the things that's so interesting about Lincoln is that he managed to be self-confident without being arrogant, which is really hard. We were talking about the difference between being stubborn and determined. Well, how about the difference between being confident and arrogant? He immersed himself in the details of the campaigns that were unfolding and were not unfolding, and decided to make difficult military decisions, which, by the way, military historians in retrospect have not found fault with. He actually was as good at understanding the lay of the land and the logistical situation as his generals. So Lincoln, but that's not predictable. It's not predictable that a president is going to immerse himself in the details, nor is it predictable that by immersing themselves in the details, they'll do a better job than the experts. It just so happened in Lincoln's case, we Americans were lucky that we had a president who was capable of outthinking his generals.
I wonder, Tim Naftali, back to this one point raised earlier in the program about being truthful, delivering the truth, bad or good. Of course, we have a completely different media environment in the era of Lincoln. News takes days, weeks to disseminate across all of these United States at that time. Was that a factor? Some of the early battleground news was not good for the Union Army in the Civil War.
Well, he used various techniques to get the story out that he wanted. He used letters and then had friendly newspapers publish them. One thing to keep in mind is in that era, newspapers didn't pretend to be objective. They were understandably at the time slanted. They were owned either by friends or opponents of the party in power. The standard of objective news that we sought professionally in the 20th century and are fighting for in the 21st century, that wasn't even an expectation in that era.
Mm-hmm. Our time is slipping away. This is such a fascinating conversation. After just 15 minutes, I know we could spend the entire afternoon talking about it, but we do not have that much time. We have until 1 o'clock Iowa time. Let's march on, if we could. Tim Walch, we can't skip over the great epidemic of 100 years ago, can we?
No. In 1918, of course, another election year, federal election year, it was our congressional elections, and also a time of war with Woodrow Wilson as our president. And in many ways, Wilson completely ignored the so-called Spanish flu epidemic. It, again, like this current epidemic, which unfortunately is being attributed to China, the epidemic of flu in 1918-1919 was attributed to Spain, not because it started in Spain, but because Spain had been reporting the flu, whereas the embargo on news in this country tended to have the newspapers minimize the impact of the flu epidemic. And without federal leadership, without a vision, it was left to individual health departments in different cities to decide how to apply it. So in one case in Philadelphia, where the health commissioner allowed a bond rally to go forth, there were thousands and thousands of people who came down with the flu, whereas in St. Louis, where they did social distancing and isolation quarantining, they had far less. So it was very uneven. And Wilson, of course, was really a casualty. Both he and his several members of his family caught the flu. They thought in part, I mean, he was sort of delusional with fever and all the rest. So you, in looking back, whereas we accord Wilson a lot of credit as president for many things, we certainly don't accord him any merits for being a crisis manager, not in the case of the flu.
Well, on that point of unevenness across the United States, we do have a federal system. We have to keep that in mind. But a hallmark of the COVID crisis is unevenness as well, isn't it?
Sure. Well, it is because we allow the states to make their own decisions. And you can see when you see these maps of mandatory social isolation and so forth, some states choose to do so, some others have not. You can hear the resistance here in Iowa. You know, there's pressure on local levels asking the governor to declare, mandatory quarantining and so forth. There's just resistance.
Yeah, Tim Naftali.
When we jump ahead, we will at some point, I think, talk about Katrina. One of the reasons for the awful response and the slow and the lethal response in the case of Hurricane Katrina was this problem of federalism. It's not a problem. It's a fact of life in our country. But the competition among layers of government is a significant day-to-day reality, and it is hard to cut through it at a time of crisis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to put in just a quick a positive word, too, for the flood response in 1927, because in some ways it was unprecedented. The federal government generally did not get into flood relief or mitigation of natural disasters. And to Coolidge's credit, and I suppose to Hoover's ambition, he certainly took the initiative, that is Hoover, along with the approval from Coolidge, and the American Red Cross to respond to the flood. There's a lot of problems with the way that was handled, and there was a lot of racism and other things involved in it. But in many ways, it was a really significant effort on the part of the federal government to do something that was essentially a local crisis.
While we're on the theme of flood disasters, let's go back to what you mentioned, Tim Naftali, and hear a little bit of President George W. Bush speaking on the Hurricane Katrina aftermath. This is from Jackson Square in New Orleans, September 15th, 2005. Bush discussing the devastation and recovery efforts in response to Hurricane Katrina.
Tonight, so many victims of the hurricane and the flood are far from home and friends and familiar things. You need to know that our whole nation cares about you. And in the journey ahead, you're not alone. To all who carry a burden of loss, I extend the deepest sympathy of our country. To every person who has served and sacrificed in this emergency, I offer the gratitude of our country. And tonight, I also offer this pledge of the American people. Throughout the area hit by the hurricane, we will do what it takes. We will stay as long as it takes to help citizens rebuild their communities and their lives. And all who question the future of the Crescent City need to know. There is no way to imagine America without New Orleans. And this great city will rise again.
Then President George W. Bush, September of 2005 in New Orleans. Tim Naftali, what did you hear there? What do you want to bring out more about the presidential leadership that George W. Bush displayed here?
Well, The story is complicated, but it looks as if, first of all, there was the problem of getting good information. The W administration had the same trouble that the HW administration had in the case of Hurricane Andrew in Florida at getting good information on the ground. Secondly, it appears that there was tension between Baton Rouge and Washington and D.C. over what role, if any, the U.S. troops should play. And initially, the governor of New Orleans was resistant to having federal intervention. Mm-hmm. At the same time, President Bush made a series of errors. He didn't push hard enough, And then he made an unfortunate photo op. And it's funny, again, it's hard to know what people will remember, but a major blow to the kind of leadership that one expected at the time came from that picture of Bush in a plane in Air Force One looking down on the people, the suffering people of New Orleans.
Yes.
And the sense was he was aloof, he was distant, he was uncaring and unknowing. Well, it actually was an unfair photograph, but the White House put it out, which was a self-inflicted wound. So what Katrina showed was a number of problems, again, in a time of crisis, involving competition among the levels of government. Secondly, the difficulty to get good information during a crisis that hits a natural crisis, national disaster. And finally, the importance of the president being a source of realistic information and of hope and of action. And the W administration failed
right
on all three levels.
We have a minute or two before we go to break. George W. Bush, also well known for the crisis of 9/11, handling that, speaking from the devastation of New York City. Tim Walsh, soon thereafter, George W. Bush's relatively young president, his popularity skyrockets, right, with his call for unity.
Well, absolutely. And of course, the difference between a natural disaster and having the country attacked are two fundamentally different types of disasters. Just the same way trying to deal with an unseen crisis like a medical or public health emergency. I want to go back a little bit to what Tim said, because what's interesting about W is two casual remarks. One, again, in New Orleans, we all remember Brownie. I think his name was Michael Brown, who was head of FEMA at the time. Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. Well, nobody in New Orleans believed Brownie was doing a heck of a job, and it sort of depicted President Bush as being clueless. But the other is with President George W. Bush standing on the rock pile at the World Trade Center and saying, you know, I hear you and the world hears you. I mean, these are both casual comments that are now etched in our memory about how President George W. Bush responded to crises. And you're absolutely right. We give him high marks in a way, or certainly the public did at the time, for his response to the crisis at 9/11, both in being compassionate, but also then in being direct and responsive.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment. Tim Walsh, presidential historian, as well as Tim Naftali, our two presidential historians, walking us through highlighting some crises from past presidents to put our current crisis in context, in historical context. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll dive into the Great Depression and hear from FDR in just a moment. Back with Tim Naftali and Tim Walsh, our presidential historians. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Tim Naftali, presidential historian, former director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library, now clinical associate professor of history and public service at New York University. Also with us, another Tim Walsh, director emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. They are walking us through crises, significant crises faced by previous U.S. presidents. We've heard highlights from the 18th century into the 19th century. We're on into the 20th century. Let's talk a little bit more, though it was mentioned in the first half hour, about the Great Depression. Let's hear from FDR when he was inaugurated in the early 30s. The country was in the throes of the Great Depression. Several million Americans heard his address broadcast via radio. Here's Franklin Delano Roosevelt on March 4th, 1933.
This is a day of national consecration. And I am certain that on this day, my fellow Americans expect that on my induction into the presidency, I will address them with a candor and a decision which the present situation of our people impels. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. We face our common difficulties.
Okay, then the inauguration in March of 1933, FDR speaking there. Of course, FDR taking the reins from Herbert Hoover, Tim Walsh.
Right, and in fact, the period of time, as Tim alluded to, between the election, as it was for Lincoln, election in November and inauguration in March, the same was true for Hoover and Roosevelt. In that period of time, after the election of Franklin Roosevelt, but before he was inaugurated, we had a bank crisis. The country was in a turmoil, a lot of tension. What Roosevelt could do with that wonderful speech and those words about fear is to, if not actually calm, at least give people a sense of vision or direction or confidence. Now, some of it might be a little bit bombastic, but nevertheless, it was the right words at the right time, followed by 100 days of real activity. So, as Tim suggested earlier, a president can say a few things, but then has to follow up with action. And then, of course, you eventually have people embracing the New Deal, and then there's a second wave of New Deal, Social Security, and some of the other things that we think of when we say New Deal. But with Roosevelt, his ability to communicate, to use the radio, as Tim suggested, with fireside chats every so often. In fact, he used to say that on a warm day in New York, if Roosevelt was giving a fireside chat, all the windows would be open, and you could be walking on the street, and you wouldn't miss a word of the speech.
Amazing. Yeah,
that's probably overstating it, but the truth is people listened to what Roosevelt had to say, and they, of course, saw the results. It took time. It took 10 years, obviously, to address the crisis of the Great Depression, but the country embraced him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one thing that's also important, too, is that the FDR that gave his inaugural speech in 1933 wasn't the same FDR of 5 years later. It's not that he as a human being changed. It's that his ideas about how to deal with the crisis changed. So when we talk about the president having an idea, having a vision, that vision has to also be changeable as circumstances change. The New Deal that he put in place in 1933 was intellectually, spiritually, programmatically, not the kind of New Deal that he was trying to put in place in 1938. That's because some of the things didn't work, and secondly, his ideas about how to manage government and public policy changed. So the real trick, the real challenge for a president is to change his mind without losing the country, because he's changed his mind.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting then, Tim Naftali, in historical perspective, that's you know it as a presidential historian, but that's a little known among the general public. People who are acquainted with the Great Depression don't really know that evolution, do they?
No, they don't. And in fact, I mean, Tim Walsh knows so much more about this than I do. But Tim can tell you about Herbert Hoover's frustration. I'm not going to step,
sure.
I'm not going to step on his toes. But Tim, tell everybody how frustrated Hoover was, because some of what Roosevelt put in place in 1933, the Hoover administration had recommended.
That's right. Absolutely. I mean, this is where, in effect, you're talking in a room or talking to the country and people just aren't listening. They'd lost confidence in Hoover. Hoover's reputation had been so great upon entering the presidency that people had such high expectations. And then when we faced this economic, unprecedented in many ways, economic collapse, Hoover did have plans. He had a vision of what to do, but he lacked that communication ability. And so with Roosevelt, what you have is a different voice, but many of the same programs. So that first 100 days were really, in many ways, Hoover programs in the hopper. But as Tim suggests, Roosevelt's real genius was his flexibility. You know, when somebody asked him what his philosophy was, he said, well, I'm a Christian and I'm a Democrat. I mean, he was flexible and open. He had the ability to have a sense of what the American people wanted and to capsulize it in a way that communication makes it being one of the most fundamentally important elements of a presidential response to a crisis.
Presidential leader.
And that, by the way, I was just going to say, and that is that unknowable thing that we presidential historians and citizens have to always think about, which is presidential charisma. Why some of our leaders have it and others don't. Why some are just credible, absolutely credible, and some are not. What Roosevelt understood was he had to distance himself from Hoover, and that he could say the same, give the same ideas as Hoover, and the American people would accept them. But if he let Hoover say them before he came to office, they would fail.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's why he kept his talk about social distancing. Roosevelt would have nothing to do with Hoover. Anyway.
We have about 15 minutes left of our program, so much archive sound, and we won't be able to hear all of it. But so I would like, Tim Naftali, could you characterize the challenge that came later in the FDR's administration? December 7th, 1941, that is a date that any person of an older generation will know instantly as Pearl Harbor Day. So there's a very different sort of threat crisis that FDR faced.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, FDR had given the impression in the 1940 campaign, which was an unprecedented campaign. He was the first American president to have a third term, the first one to even seek a third term. And the American public wanted to stay out of the war. And the main threat was viewed as Germany. And suddenly the United States gets attacked by Japan. This would later lead to unfounded conspiracy theories about how the war came about. But what this president, that president, FDR, faced was a potentially huge loss of confidence, a credibility crisis because of this, of the surprise that occurred at Pearl Harbor. Now, what he does is he shows great determination. One of the most, I think, inspirational moments of that early part of the American World War II is the sight of Roosevelt walking, obviously with crutches and carefully with help, but walking up to the rostrum in the House of Representatives to give the speech, to give the date of infamy speech. He knew that if he went up in a wheelchair, if he did not go under his own steam, that would somehow make the world, like the American people, think of themselves and their country as disabled, and he didn't want that.
Okay,
so he understood that he had to do it. So the speech you'll hear is a speech that he gives in pain. He's deeply tired, but he doesn't show it because he has, with leg irons, walked up to give that speech to send a signal to the country: we are determined.
Okay, let's hear, with that backdrop, that information, let's hear President Franklin D. Roosevelt declaring war on Japan. This is from December 8, 1941.
Hostilities exist. There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
FDR in 1941. Let's leap ahead a few decades to John F. Kennedy's crisis in the early 60s, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Tim Walsh, could you give us a little backdrop for the televised speech of extraordinary gravity that President Kennedy gave in October of 1962?
Right. For those of us of a certain age who were in elementary school or grade school at the time will remember the apprehension, the fear, as even as children, that missiles were discovered by a U-2 overflight, missile launchers being constructed on Cuba. And remember, this is following the Bay of Pigs invasion that failed, and the Cuban people were apprehensive about United States' plans against Cuba, and so they enlisted the Soviets in installing these missile launchers, with the expectation now that they were going to have protection. But of course, that in effect put the United States at crisis. A relatively young president who had not had good relations with Nikita Khrushchev, and so in October of 1962. President Kennedy, once these missiles were discovered, and again, the whole idea of telling the truth goes before the American people, to tell them what these missiles were and then what our plans were. And it was controversial at the time to have a quarantine of the island of Cuba until those missile launchers were removed. We didn't send... I think it was General LeMay wanted us to go ahead and just bomb Cuba. But we did say, no, these must be removed. And so eventually we came back from the brink of war.
Here's John Kennedy, October of 1962.
To halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba from whatever nation or port where they're found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union. I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace and to stable relations between our two nations. I call upon him further to abandon this course of world domination and to join in an historic effort to end the perilous arms race and to transform the history of man. Our goal is not the victory of might, but the vindication of right. Not peace at the expense of freedom, but both peace and freedom here in this hemisphere. And we hope around the world, God willing, that goal will be achieved.
President Kennedy in 1962. Tim Naftali, comment on the presidential leadership in that crisis. What you see as important to pull out of it, to learn from it as a crisis president.
Well, that was an era when Americans were reassured by eloquence. What's interesting now is we as a people don't seem to need eloquence as our forefathers or forebearers did. Kennedy could have suffered an enormous credibility crisis because only 6 weeks before he gave that speech, he tried to reassure Americans that the Soviets would not put missiles in Cuba. He had sent a secret back channel message to the Soviets to determine whether or not they would be doing something as foolish as putting offensive weapon systems in Cuba. They told him they would not. And so what the president did is he drew a red line by saying, we would not, as an American people, we would not countenance the placement of offensive weapon systems in Cuba. He did that not thinking the Soviets would cross that line. And then they did. So what he had to do was not only send a signal to Khrushchev, but also establish credibility with the American people, and the so-called quarantine speech did. The other thing that's worth keeping in mind is that Kennedy wanted to bomb Cuba. He was one of those who felt that he had no choice but to bomb the missile sites because he had told the American people that there wouldn't be missile sites. And that first week of the crisis, in an era when the press either didn't get the story or didn't leak it, it's inconceivable now. During that week, the president had to cool down and ultimately decided to go with a quarantine, but he didn't think it would work because the quarantine would only work if the Soviets removed what they already had in Cuba. They already had missiles in Cuba. Quarantine was great for those missiles on their way to Cuba, and there were some, but there were a lot already there. And so Kennedy was taking a chance that the Soviets would be more afraid of the consequences of this action, of their action, than we Americans were. In the end, Kennedy proved to be right. So he showed statesmanship, he showed cool, but he also took a risk. And he did so publicly in his very few public comments. He only made two public comments at the beginning and the end of the crisis. But he found a way to communicate information to the American people and to the Soviets that managed to make the Soviets understand his resolve and the American people trust his resolve. That was leadership.
Final 5 minutes with our two presidential historians this hour, Tim Naftali, former director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library, Tim Walch, the director emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, of course, here in West Branch, Iowa. We have a few minutes remaining in this hour, gentlemen, to, with the historical context that we have and perhaps others that you want to bring to other contexts you want to bring to the fore, to comment on this particular crisis at this time and this president. We have the epidemic. It's sort of a twin crisis. It is a twin crisis. The pandemic, COVID-19 pandemic, and causing, we don't know really what kind of economic crisis. We know the initial economic crisis. We don't know whether we're heading into a recession or something worse than that. Tim Walch, what are your final reflections this hour with this sort of historical context behind the present times?
Right. Well, one of the, of course, consolations of being an historian is that you can look back and you know what the variables are, and you, there's a sort of omniscience. I understand what happened. I can see the patterns. I can see how things come out. And, of course, what we're hearing from lots of people in social media and in television and advertising and so forth, public service announcements, we'll get through this, we're better together, we'll stand together, and so forth. Because we want to, in effect, nourish our sense of encouragement going forward. On the other hand, we're very apprehensive. I mean, by definition, we don't know what the future is going to bring. If you're in the service industry, will you have a job? Will you get sick? How sick will you get? And there's a tendency, of course, for news and information to concentrate on the most dramatic and in some ways most negative or horrific story. So there is an apprehension going forward. But it does, as an historian, I think I take comfort in knowing that the past informs the present and the future in the sense that we seem to have an extraordinary resolve to find a solution no matter how much of a challenge we face.
Tim Naftali, your concluding remarks?
The crisis like what we're suffering through and fighting through now, historically, these crises bring us together, obviously, with the exception of the Civil War. What's so troubling about this crisis, besides the uncertainty that we now face, is the extent to which it is not yet has not yet brought us together. The 2000 campaign was so divisive, and the outcome of that campaign was so divisive. And yet, after 9/11, George W. Bush enjoyed 92% public approval rating, which meant that people were deeply unhappy about the fact that there wasn't a President Gore, understood that this president, the one that they didn't like, was at least doing his best for the country after 9/11. We're not seeing that right now. We are seeing a bump in support for President Trump, but it's not the enormous increase in support that one saw for President Kennedy during his crises, that one saw for Franklin Roosevelt, that one saw for George H.W. Bush. And that's because he isn't using rhetoric to bring us all together. He is still pitting governors against each other, regions against each other. Let's hope that stops. Mm-hmm. Because we're all in this together. So that's a change in presidential rhetoric that would be for the better and that needs to happen. All of his predecessors, all of them, have talked about national interests and have thought about it as a national challenge. He would be the first not to, and let's hope he changes his way. Let's hope he alters his vision and approach the way that our best crisis managers have in the past.
A few seconds to react to that, to Tim Walch.
Very eloquently said. Absolutely. If we can take a lesson from this, the flexibility that we saw in Franklin Roosevelt, that sense of vision and purpose and determination needs to be infused in President Trump. If he wants to be remembered as he thinks he will be remembered, because right now he's not succeeding. He's barely at 50%. He might think that's great at this point, but it's so far below what our other presidents in times of crisis have been able to achieve in terms of bringing the people together.
Tim Walch, presidential historian, retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim Naftali, former director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library, now clinical associate professor of history and public service at New York University. You make such a great team, the two Tims. Thank you both.
Tim times two.
Thank you, Ben.
For joining
Thank
us.
Right, you betcha.
Tomorrow on the program, we'll be joined by Peter Hansen of Grinnell College, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, our two political scientists for Politics Wednesday. River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, Rick, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.